Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the regular February 3rd meeting of the Morro Bay Planning Commission. Let the record show that all commissioners are present. The meeting is called to order, and we will begin, as always, with a moment of silence. Thank you. And if you'll all stand and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, thank you very much. This is a period that we've set aside for announcements from the planning commissioners. Are there any announcements to be made this evening? No, we're amazingly taciturn tonight, in contrast to our usual state of affairs. So this is the time then for public comment. Any person who's here that would like to address the commission on a matter that is not on tonight's agenda, please come forward to the microphone and state your name and let us hear what you have to say. Okay, seeing none, we will move right on ahead to the consent calendar. We have on the consent calendar the approval of minutes from our meeting of January 6th and the current and advanced planning processing list. Would anybody like to pull either of those for discussion, or would staff like to comment on either of those items? I think there is one small possible correction in the minutes. On the consent calendar from the January 6th meeting, it has me listed as moving to approve the consent calendar. I'm pretty sure it was somebody else, but does anybody remember making that? You made the motion, and does anybody remember who seconded it? Because it has Terry seconding the motion. I don't think we're going to go to court over this, but
I'll review my notes when I always take the motions and the seconds and everything. I have it in my notes. I'll verify what it was and correct it.
Okay. I appreciate that. So with that correction or with that stipulation, is there a motion to approve the consent calendar? Okay, that's Catherine. That's moving to approve. Second?
I'll second.
Great. All those in favor?
Awesome. Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes 5-0. So moving on then to our public hearing for this evening. We have only one public hearing tonight. It's case number UP0-399 involving a proposal at 430 Nassau Street here in Morro Bay. And I think Joan has the report for us.
Yes, sir. Good evening. Thank you, Chairman Teft and Commissioners. The item before you this evening is use permit number 399. It's looking for approval at 430 Nassau Street to allow an addition exceeding 25% of the existing floor area to a single-family residence with a non-conforming lot coverage and front setback. The property is located in North Morro Bay to the east of Highway 1 within the R1 S1 single family residential zone and outside of the California Coastal Commission appeals jurisdiction. The house was built in 1986 with 906 square feet of habitable floor area and a single car garage, which is similar to other homes in the neighborhood. This is the site as seen from Nassau Street. The existing one-story single-family residence is surrounded by two-story homes, and although you can't see it in this picture, the homes in the rear of the lot along Mindoro Street are also two stories. So current requirements of the Morro Bay Municipal Code for lot coverage and setbacks render the existing structure nonconforming. The minimum front yard setback in the S1 overlay district is 10 feet. And the existing house is located at 9 feet 8 inches. However, the applicant is proposing to move the front wall of the structure back to the 10-foot setback to fix that nonconformity. And then with that small amount of square footage that you're gaining or losing, I guess, you're bringing the lot coverage percentage down a slight amount, so there is a slight improvement to that nonconformity. This is the existing floor plan showing the nonconforming front setback along the garage and the covered patio on the second, or the covered patio is also at 10 feet, you can see there. So this is the proposed site plan. It shows the existing garage pulled back to meet that 10-foot setback and the second covered and enclosed parking space, which is required due to the additional square footage. A house that is over 1,000 square feet would require a second covered and enclosed parking space. And that new garage is pulled back approximately 5 feet or so, and the overhanging second-story deck is also within that 10-foot setback. I would also like to add a condition of approval to the resolution, requiring that the cumulative width of the driveways can be no more than 50% of the frontage of the lot. So we're going to need to lessen the width of one of those driveways for a total of 20 feet. This is the proposed second floor plan. And then the elevations, the front and the rear elevations. You can see the exterior staircase there to the left and the front elevation. The east and west side elevations. And staff recommends the commission adopt resolution 0515, which includes the findings and conditions of approval, including the added condition concerning the total driveway width, for coastal development permit number as UP0399 at 430 Nassau Street. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thanks.
Thank you, Joan. Are there any questions for staff? Michael.
Jim, we've got 55.9% lot coverage, but we're moving the front wall. Why didn't we... Did we consider asking for 50% coverage instead of the 56?
Well, with 906 square feet of habitable floor area and a single car garage, they're already over. They're at 56.4% lot coverage. No, we didn't. In that they're fixing the front setback nonconformity and slightly improving the lot coverage. So at this point, we did not ask for that.
Did we look at Royal We? Did we look at the lot coverage of the adjacent parcels? Are the other parcels smaller, larger? Do they meet the 50% target?
I do not know. I apologize. No, I did not look.
Yeah, I had a question. Anyone else? Jerry, go ahead.
Do we have any conditions in here? I didn't see any. As far as restricting the usage of the third floor deck to, you know, any furniture or structures up there, movable structures be kept below the maximum allowable height.
We did not put a condition in there at this time. No.
Okay.
I had one question. The house was apparently built in 1986. Was it in conformity at the time that it was built, or was there a variance provided for it, or do we know anything about the history of how it came to be at 55.9%?
Yeah, no. The only historical data we have on this is a building permit for the construction of the home, and there was no variance.
So then we don't know whether there were different criteria in place in 1986 for
our codes would be much as they are today. It was a little bit unclear. When the applicant initially approached the city, I was the one that they spoke with, and I looked through and researched it. And again, as Joan indicated, all we had was indications of a building permit. It was kind of unclear you know, how it got there or what happened. Nice. When we looked at it, you know, when it came in and I was working with the architect on the plan, you know, we just wanted to make sure by our code that you're not making nonconformities worse. And in fact, we sort of improved them by adding parking and reducing the front setback in the front a little bit. Does it comply with everything? No. We didn't have them do that. We just had them, and all the changes that they were making. And we had about two or three different iterations of the plan, I think, that he kind of, we went back and forth on trying to get something that, you know, we could at least bring forward to the commission. This is a little different than some of the other ones that you see, you know, that come forward, these expansion of nonconforming structures. But in doing some other research, we have other ones that are similar to this. So thought that, you know, it was worth bringing forward.
Okay. All right.
So, I do have a question.
Sure.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that I read that it will be a sprinklered property. Is that correct? For fire safety?
I think. Yeah, I think I saw that too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's just such a large property in a small area.
And close. Yeah. Sure.
Could you expand on this new resolution with the driveways? Because I rode my bike by the property there, and I just want to make sure that we're looking at something still functional for both garages.
Yes. The let's see. So, looking at this site plan, the driveway connecting to the existing garage is paved all the way to the edge of the house. So if they were to shorten that, it would bring it into conformity with Section 174430, which states that with one or more driveways, the maximum coverage is 50% of the frontage. So they have the space. It shouldn't be too hard to make that work.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go ahead.
Back to my last line of interrogation. Was it ever considered to request that the upper floor meet the 50% limit for the site?
The second floor would not doesn't add anything to the lot coverage.
No, but I mean, in terms of the footprint that's exceeding the target for the first floor, in other words, if we're going to build up, would we consider, in effect, getting the second floor back to the 50%? I guess what I'm concerned about is it's more of a comment thing.
It never occurred to me because that's not how we calculate lot coverage. I mean, that's about the simplest answer I can give you. It's based on the footprint of the house, and so it never occurred to me when I was dealing with them when they came in originally to reduce the second floor. It was because that's not by definition how we calculate lot coverage. I mean, it never occurred to me.
Yeah. They could add a third, if it was allowed, they could add a third story with 1,200 square feet and the lot coverage would still be the same.
Although along the same lines, because of the second floor, the balcony that's located over part of the garage, the second floor has a balcony that's located over part of the first floor garage. It may, in fact, the square footage of the second story may, in fact, be 50% or less of the lot. I didn't calculate it. But
if you take up that second,
it is
second
smaller
floor
than
deck.
The first floor. Okay.
Just a comment, just an observation. If they relocated the exterior, okay, let me clarify. The stairway going up on the exterior, that's counted in the lot coverage?
It is not.
Oh, it is not?
No.
Hmm. Okay. Thought anything over 30 inches was determined to be lot coverage.
I believe open and uncovered stairs are excluded.
Okay.
I think that's what it is.
Okay. Are we excited by it?
Checking. Checking the Bible.
Yeah, I apologize for not having that.
That's good.
That was one of my big questions when we initially looked at the project, was determining whether or not.
To tell you the truth, it's gone back and forth
on
different projects that have come forward.
So is that the architectural extension?
I think it's 110.
Richard, now's the time for your karaoke.
I have one there.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
We found the policy that allows you to stare to encroach into the setback.
Could Scott then, while she's looking that up, do you know if the stairways were included as far as the calculation or not?
I know that they definitely were not added into the lot coverage, yeah. So 17.12.92 is the definition of lot coverage. Lot coverage means the coverage of a lot by all portions of the building, either at or above ground level, including garages, carports, roofed porches, and cantilevered portions of the building. And the area of raised uncovered decks over 30 inches in height, which encroach into any setback areas. But they're not encroaching into any setback areas. They're allowed to encroach in the setback area with the stairway, but they're not.
Okay.
So I believe it's like the decking. If you have a deck that over or under 30 inches that encroaches into the setback, the portion of the deck that is not in the setback does not get counted, but the portion that is in the setback does get counted. And I think that was our logic in not including the stairway in the lot coverage.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have an interpretation memo to that effect as well. It's actually in the zoning code.
Okay. Now, if we could only understand the logic of that section of the code, we'd be in good shape.
That's another story.
No argument there. We've gone round and round internally about it and kind of went, okay, this is how they do it, but it's not real clear.
I do have one follow-up question, and I believe you may have answered it, but the stairwell, the stairs do not go into, when you calculated the setback on that side of the house, they were not included?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
So then we'll open this up to the public. We'd like to hear from you. Normally we reserve the first comments for the applicant or the applicant's representative. So if one of you is here, please come to the microphone and talk to us.
Hello, I'm the architect, Clint Iwanica. I'm here for any questions, but it sounds like Joan did a great job at answering all the questions that you may have had, but I'm here for you.
Okay. Very good. Would anybody like to address questions to the gentleman? Very good. Okay, thank you. We'll bring it back to the commission for comment. Anyone feel like leading off?
I'll lead off. One of the things I did notice on this particular street that across the street, they're almost all single story. Mm-hmm. And on this side of the street that we're talking about, it's like pretty much two story everywhere and even in the back. Because I was like wondering, and a neighbor to the east, I like that house. I kind of like it. My wife's an artist, so she would paint it like that. I liked the, to me, when I first saw this, I kind of liked the stepped garage idea to articulate the front and kind of like, it kind of flagged that where maybe the guidelines are being implemented, you know? I feel that the project
is kind of like with the neighborhood compatibility, it kind of works in that neighborhood, with especially with that side of the street and all the two stories around it. But okay. I'm open to comments
there. Okay. Michael?
Yeah, I think this is a really nice looking project. I think it's well conceived. I don't have any particular comments. My comments, the two things I'll say, they aren't because of this project, but they're because of questions this raises. I really don't think if we have a 50% limit, we should be encouraging people to volumetrically extend what's already an oversized construction. So I would say, personally, if I was a neighbor, or if we had a different kind of project in a different kind of neighborhood, I'd be very upset that we were letting people exceed what was the footprint as we continue up in volume. Because if we're talking about height bulk issues, if we've got a first floor limitation about what the coverage is, every time we exceed that and then extend up, in effect, we're adding volume up above that shouldn't have been there. This project, I don't think, is one that I want to pin to that. But as we go forward, though, I do think somebody should offer mitigation if they can't meet that criteria. And in this case, because of the things Richard talked about with the step backs, it does seem like some of the things we were talking about for compatibility are built into the design already. It is an attractive design. You know, they've got the split garages, you're entering, there's porches, it's set back. You know, it's a nice use of some of the motifs of craftsman thinking. But that part bothers me. I'm not going to withdraw support from it, but that part bothers me. The other part is, and if we get to the third floor, we start doing decks, it's even more. The other thing is, one of the things Dr. Teft mentioned, and I'm not a total support of this, but when we were talking about the neighborhood compatibility, it was this idea of upper-level decks. And when we get up to the third floor and we build a deck out to the edge of the setback, I think that potentially is something we haven't seen too much of here yet. Now, if I'm the architect, I'm going to try to do it because I want the view from the third floor. And it could be based on where people are kind of, you know, niching the house with that footprint, that it makes more sense to have that deck somewhere on the footprint than another because of the views. You know, the views around here are very specific when you're in a particular place. I would just say that when we go forward with our zoning look, I would almost like to see us pull decks back away from edges and not build right out at the setback. You know, I think that that's a tough thing. I don't think this one is a problem. This is a dense neighborhood, has been noted. I think the design is a very strong one for compatibility. But those two issues, I think, are ones that this one mitigates because it's a nicer design. But I think down the line, I don't want to set a precedent for building up. And I guess that'd be a question. Are we setting a precedent for saying we're allowing an existing situation to be continued up in volume? I mean, I'm willing to say they've made design mitigation to make it acceptable. But I don't want to just carte blanche say every time somebody has a yard setback problem. We had that before a couple meetings ago. People were building within, we had the 6-inch one last time or something like that, where we had the 6-inch setback and people are, but they, I don't think they built on that 6-inch setback. I think the upper floor was pulled back away. But we've had other ones, though, where we've had setback violations and people are extending up in volume. And I think that's a really dangerous precedent to take. It's almost like you have to look at every project extremely carefully so that people don't see that as a precedent, that all these conditions like this automatically give you that extra volume. Because I think we'll find a neighborhood at some point or a project at some point that that'll come back to bite us in the derriere. Okay. So that's all. I'm in support of the project, but those are two concerns I would.
Gerald?
I had this similar concern. and was going to bring it up, especially with the third floor deck. And, you know, not only did we increase that lot coverage on the second floor, but then adding a third floor above that seems to, you know, kind of inflict a little more pain or, you know, into it. So, you know, I think they did a fairly good rendering of the problem and made the street side fairly nice for a real small project, for a real small lot. The one thing I would bring back to the commission is that we're already, you know, I would not want to see, you know, umbrellas and tiki bars and, you know, double height bunk beds or whatever up on top of that deck. So I would like to see, a condition on here that restricts any furniture, barbecues, umbrellas to be, you know, basically anything be below the maximum allowable height of the site. So,
if I'm not mistaken, we've had that issue come up before, and I thought we had something in our testaments there that spoke to that.
Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, we don't have any policy language, zoning code language, and limitations to that. I have seen the condition on a project from maybe a couple of years ago that came forward in building that had that limitation in it.
Down on Birch Street, we had a series of four lots that were built out that had third floor decks, and I think we put that condition on then.
Okay. It's actually good to know if that is a concern of the commission because, if that's something you're interested in, we can bring that forward, and then I can put that on my list of things to maybe add into the code as we move forward with, amending it and amending the general plan, that type of thing.
I think that's absolutely critical because the average person coming in, if they're doing due diligence, sees side yard setbacks, sees a volumetric profile. And it's my same concern that I had before about the trees. You know, one has a reasonable expectation that the spaces that have been reserved by code are not going to be violating the idea of views. Now, I understand if a person is standing up there, I don't think we can condition it to make them crawl up there.
They're going to crawl around. Well, they probably wouldn't have a roof deck if you made them do that because the reason for the roof deck is the view, and if you can't look above it, then...
Probably has more to do if there's a rooftop bar up there. But I think the idea, though, is that permanent structures... I even wonder about things like heating... portable heating units and things like that. I think I've seen a few flagpoles on some of these in town. And, so there's a lot of kind of features that we could get into that I think we want to be careful of. Just because especially in the flats there, if anything that goes above there starts to impact the views that some of these other people have. And I think the assumption should be a reasonable person is going to assume we're going to protect the envelope that we do have, even when we're talking about, bulk and scale. We can't let anything exceed that. I don't believe.
Well, one of the concerns I have is, a couple weeks ago or just a couple, we've had 45, 50 knot winds, in the Santa Anas. So you get one of these heaters, space heaters or an umbrella up there, and it could go miles on that. And so I just would like to see any furniture below the maximum.
How would we enforce something like that?
It would just be a code enforcement from a neighbor complaining. Yeah. I mean, we're not going to be sending the Gestapo out there to check with a tape measure, but if they get egregious, then a neighbor would probably complain.
And I just would chime in on this whole thing. It looks like that provision would give them about 4 feet. So most chaise lounges, chairs, barbecue grills, and stuff would still be able to fit. Mm-hmm. Catherine,
thank you. I think they It was it's a very interesting and I think creative way to enlarge the home within a very small lot. I mean, basically going from one bedroom to four bedrooms, from one bath to three baths. I was concerned about scale and how large it was, and I do believe the articulation with the, as it had been mentioned by other commissioners, for the garages help on that. It's not a full flat face. One of the things, though, we will have considerable amount over, you know, a garage facing the street. And I see, at least in the renderings here, that there was kind of a designer garage door on there. And I would like to encourage that they continue to have something that's just not your normal metal roll-up doors, that they do something a little bit more creative on it, because that is a lot of garage, especially separated out by a very small space for the entry. That's my concern.
Yeah, I thought this was a pretty good design also. I mean, we've got an articulated roof line. We've got the articulation of the balcony. We've got the different planes for the different parts of the garage. And I guess one of my favorite things is the fact that we have two smaller garage doors instead of this one vast expanse of garage door, which I think will be much more attractive, to tell you the truth. I did do a little, you know, quick back of the envelope math here, and the lot is 2,400 square feet, and the floor area of the second story is 1,200 square feet. So, the second story in this case does appear to meet what, if it were put on the ground, it would meet the lot coverage requirement. So, I think maybe by chance, this addresses some of Commissioner Lucas's concerns on that. And you know, I think that's maybe a direction that we should consider going forward, is, you know, that the commission will look more favorably on a project if they attempt to move in that direction. So I really don't have any strong issues with this. I think I had one more comment, but it seems to have jumped out of my brain at the moment. So,
I've got one more. Yeah. I just want to say, I want to compliment the designer, because the drawings are very easy to read. They're coded in a way that you can tell what's window, you know, some of the key materials. They've got a little bit of shade on them so that the massing jumps out. So this is a very nice set to show people that this is a very clean way to present things simply.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I do remember what the other comment. You know, just looking again, putting the numbers aside, just going out and looking around the neighborhood, the house does not appear to be out of scale for the other single family residences that are there. You know, when you just it doesn't hit you, you don't go, oh, you know, that one's too big, you know. So in terms of neighborhood compatibility, I think when the second I expect that when the second story is added, it will also be compatible with the existing second story two-story houses that are in the same neighborhood. So I think the comments are sort of headed in one direction. Do we have a motion? Let's back off before we do the motion and kind of get a consensus as to whether we would like to add the condition that Commissioner Luhr was proposing. Is that something that...
I would be in favor of that.
Okay. Catherine?
I would, too.
Okay. Okay. So... with that, would someone like to make a... Would you like to give us language, or would you like us to just make an emotion with that condition to be added, and you go with it in writing the resolution?
If you give me a second, I can come up with language, or you can just give us direction. I mean, that's fine. I mean, what we're going to do is come up with direction. This is the applicant. She'll... I guess, well, that's going to be interesting how we do that. But it'll be that you cannot have furniture on the roof deck that exceeds the maximum height of the house or the railing of the roof deck. Because that's the maximum height. We measure to the top of the railing or the top of the edge.
You know, the permanent features of the house are what's approved for the limit. I mean, I think the code allows us to take fireplace, chimneys, maybe a couple other things higher than the 25-foot line. And we're not seeing any of those now, and those would be exceptions as well. But, you know,
I'm just going to condition it related to furniture or other improvements that would be placed on the deck. Cannot exceed the height that's approved for the home.
Plantings.
Or would the height approved for the home or 25 feet? I mean, they're very, very similar. But
no, the height that's approved for the home, because you have a railing, and we shouldn't have anything that sticks above the railing, because then you're going to see it, and that's not going to be, from what I heard, that you want to see. So any furniture that's placed up there, any permanent improvements,
right,
like a barbecue, say, that they place up there, should be below the level of the railing that's around the edge of the deck. And so that's how I'm going to condition it.
The maximum allowable height on this is only about 9 inches above the railing.
Right.
So it's going to be hard to determine from the ground, you know, so I think they're safe. I really don't want to, you know, what my main concern is, I don't want to see umbrellas up there, you know, in these 40 knot winds.
I get it. And we listen to the commission. So on other projects, I mean, the point being is on other projects that we have that come forward like this, you'll probably see conditions that are already in it, and we'll point it out to you. Because, I mean, I have all five of you going, this is something that we're interested in. And so, you know, it would have to be the opposite. You'd have to decide that you don't want it any longer, then strike it out. I think that's probably a good way to go.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so just out of fairness, I'd like to give the applicant a chance to respond to that condition if it's objectionable to them or if they have anything that they'd like to say. Well,
I'll come up to the podium.
Oh, yeah. They're not getting you on the tape.
I don't know if I have any real comments. Well, my name is Ryan Garcia, and I don't necessarily have any comments here, but except you guys want to put a restriction on how high we can put, and I'm not going to build a gazebo on top of the third story. So, you know, it's a non-enforceable aspect of what you guys are talking about, really, because who's going to complain? My neighbors. And, you know, it's just not something that's planned that we're doing. So I guess, I don't know, just we're talking about things that probably will never develop.
Yeah,
if I put a barbecue and I lift the lid and it's over, then I'm not going to. Come on.
Good point.
Only do you leave the lid
up. Yeah.
Well, we've had conditions here. You know, we've had conditions where people have third floor decks and they have put things up there. And so it is, we just, you know, I just want to make it perfectly clear at the front so there's no confusion later. So,
well, dealing with things that will probably never happen, that's why we get paid the big bucks.
No, in all honesty, I'd bet Vegas money that if we don't do something like this, not this project, somebody's going to buy a small plastic shed and put it up on this deck because they don't want to take things up and down the steps. Oh, we'll just leave it up there. Just get this little small shed, and all of a sudden you've got a 6-foot shed up there. And then let's just leave the palm tree up there. We kind of like that. And they say, now I've got a palm tree and a shed and somebody's smoker that's 6 feet tall. You know, and pretty soon you've got clutter and the person across the street that just paid $700,000 for their beach view is obscured by stuff. So,
yeah. I would like to, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jerry.
No, go ahead. No.
I would like to comment on what Michael said about the privacy issue, because that as you know, that's a concern of mine. That's something that I think is a valid consideration in planning. And the only reason that I'm not sort of joining in on that with regard to the roof deck is this is an area where you've got a 3-foot setback on the side yard and a 5-foot setback in the backyard. Ain't nobody building swimming pools in this area. And, you know, virtually all of the houses are built to the maximum allowable. So it's privacy is somewhat less of an issue here because the neighborhood is really not very conducive to outdoor activities the kind of things that sunbathing and the kind of things that might go on in other parts of town. So to me, the nature of the neighborhood mitigates that a little bit.
Well, I'll make a motion, I guess. I'll give it a shot. And I move that we approve the resolution number PC5-15 on Exhibit A with the addition of the one amendment.
For the deck and then for the driveway?
Yes, the two.
Yeah.
The driveway and the height limitation on the furniture at the deck.
Okay.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, can we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Stowski?
Aye.
Commissioner Lucas?
Aye.
Commissioner Luer?
Yes.
Commissioner Sorensen?
Aye.
And Chair Teft?
Yes. Okay. Motion carries 5-0. Unfinished business, we have none this evening. New business, we have two items. D1 is consideration of Planning Commission letter to the city requesting inclusion in the department work program, the development of commercial and solar guidelines. And I'd like to start by thanking our subcommittee who has diligently worked on these documents brought them forward to us tonight. So. Are we going to have staff comments on this, or do we just wing it on our own?
It's really for your discussion, okay. And then if you're happy with it or you as a group decide you want changes, you discuss that, direct it be sent off to City Council, and then I can make that happen.
Great. Okay. Are there any comments that would either of the subcommittee members like to?
I'd just like to, on the design guidelines for the commercial areas, I'd just like to make sure that we include streetscape in those, you know, if we're not stepping on any zoning laws.
For the commercial design guidelines,
yes.
You're talking about? Yeah, it would absolutely include things along the streetscape, yeah. Type thing, yes. That would be something that would be included in it, yes.
Okay. Yeah, we just didn't mention it in the memo, so I just wanted to...
That would be something that I would be looking to put in it. All the commercial design guidelines that I've ever seen speak to that.
Right.
So I'm not going to exclude them.
Yeah. Okay.
Would anyone else like to comment on either of these documents? Well, I just, I think there are some details that we'll need to discuss. The South Main Street, I'm not sure that commercial really goes all the way to the state park, but those are things that doesn't really matter in terms of the letter. Those are things that will work out in the process. So I think the letters look great, and I would be more than happy to entertain. Do we need a motion to send these to?
I would say, yeah, have a motion and take a...
So I would be more than happy to entertain a motion directing staff to... send these letters to the City Council on our behalf.
I'll second that.
Oh, I guess I didn't make the motion, but...
I'll move we support both letters and send them to Council.
Okay. Now I'll second that.
Okay. Great.
Do we have any other discussion for...
Discussion of the motion.
You know?
So do we need a roll call, or would a voice vote be
voice vote, yeah,
acceptable? Voice vote. Okay, so we have a motion and a second on the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Opposed? None. Motion carries 5-0. Very good. And now we have the review of the 2014 annual water report.
Yeah, we have our Public Works Director, Robert Livick, here, who's going to present that. This item comes forward to you because as we were putting the staff report together for City Council, I looked through the ordinance and found that we were supposed to show it to the Planning Commission first. So you see that staff report in front of you says City Council. That's why. So we're here and we're showing it to you. And Rob?
Thanks, Scott. This is our annual water report. It reports on WUs that have been issued and what our recommendations is for the upcoming year. One of the recommendations that we're making is to change the date of this report. The code stipulates that it needs to come to Planning Commission sometime in December and City Council in January. We don't have all the data to put the report together by December for that year, nor do we have all the water use report. So we're looking to move that, either align it with the fiscal year or the water year or some better amount of better timing to bring that forward. That's one of our recommendations, is to modify the ordinance language so that it can be more timely. The recommendations to City Council are to basically allocate, as we historically have, 50 residential units, 65 commercial units. Those will be available on a first-come, first-served basis in accordance with our general plan and LCP policies, which does put a priority for commercial above residential. We also recommended that we continue with the water retrofit program, and that new water units be offset on a 2-to-1 basis by providing retrofits to existing uses, or by paying the in-lieu fee of $2,900 per WEU. And when we brought this forward last time, it was not clear that that's $2,900 per WEU offset. So it's $5,800 for one new WEU. So we're making that a little bit more clear in this resolution. This year, water production, we produced 1,183 acre feet. Most of that was from the State Water Project at 1,141 acre feet. I estimated that we would use 1,140 acre feet. I cannot believe that we used 1,141 acre feet of State Water Project water. I was off by 1 acre foot. I should have bought lottery tickets last year or something. And then we used 41 acre feet from our Morrow Basin well field that was treated through the RO, brackish water RO side of the desal plant. We have some tables in here that show historic water usage. This last year, our water consumption was down to 103 gallons per person per day, which is less than the threshold set forth in water management plan at 130 gallons per person per day. So we're down about 7.5 percent on water usage, which is pretty good for a coastal community. Statewide average for per capita consumption is close to 3 times that amount, especially in the unmetered Central Valley, where if you don't have to account for water, you use as much as you want. Our activity, we issued 23.37 WEUs last year, 4.03 commercial WEUs, and it's because water WEUs are calculated on a square footage basis. That's how we get fractional portions. 8 single-family WEUs and 11.34 multifamily, and those were issued to the senior housing project on Main Street. That concludes my staff report. We'll be bringing this forward to City Council on February 10th for their approval of, what's the resolution number? Resolution 0715, setting the allocation and also setting the 2-to-1 offset ratio. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Yeah.
Hey, Rob, what was that number from the Morro Basin again?
41 acre feet from the Morro Basin.
And, okay, if memory serves, I'm like mechanical, so 1 acre foot, 326,000 gallons, is that right? About?
I don't know, I have to do the math. I can't remember the, all I remember is 43,560 cubic feet per acre foot, so mm-hmm. We can do the math real quick here.
Thanks.
We won't do it in our heads, though.
Yeah, it's a you civvies do things in acre foot.
About 13 million gallons.
13 million gallons. Per acre foot?
13 million gallons for the 41 acre feet.
Oh, for one and eight, 41. Yeah, okay. So for 41 acre feet is the 13 million. So that's about three, how many per acre foot? That's three, am I right?
Somewhere around
325,829 gallons per acre foot.
All right. Thank you.
Any other? Michael.
Yep. Rob, on the first page, under recommendation 5, it says retrofits to existing uses or paying in lieu fees. And then if you jump to the page 2 of the, it says annual water progress report. It's part of Exhibit A, page 2 of Exhibit A. It's got that part 5. Says retrofits, waterless urinals, waterless toilets, and then it says gray water installation in new construction. So is gray water included in 5 on number 1 by reference? Or?
May include any of the following.
Okay.
It's not an all-inclusive list.
Okay.
If somebody comes up with a innovative way and they can show us how it works, we'll accept any innovative water-saving features that can be proven that will work.
Yeah. I would just like to see us use that term any place we can.
So okay.
Because I just think that the water savings there is going to do a lot more than toilet change-outs, I would guess. Although I'm not sure about the waterless toilet. You'll have to send me what that one is.
Mainly in commercial installations, okay. You see the waterless urinals. I think we calculated if you were to change from the former code required 1.6 gallon per flush 1.2 gallon per flush toilets, you would need to retrofit several hundred toilets to come up, and it probably is not economically feasible to just do it via toilet retrofit.
Mm. Let me, are you done, Mike?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Okay. I guess this is a little bit more of a philosophical question. If we're working towards water reclamation, wouldn't we be better putting as much of the water back in through the system that we could reclaim back for usable water than putting it out as a gray water?
The cost to reclaim water has a cost. To reclaim water, it does have a cost. So water conservation is more efficient than reclaimed water.
Right.
Gray water is probably more efficient than reclaimed water because you're treating it at the source rather than piping it to a water reclamation plant, running it through the wastewater process, then the advanced treatment process, and then pumping it back wherever we're going to pump it to. So the closer you can treat it to the source is probably more efficient.
Okay, even if you're technically not needing it for irrigation because you got a native plant, you know, you're using native plants, you know, so if you're just using it to evaporate out on your, you know, in your land, it seems like it'd be better to run it back through the system to then be able to be reused as drinking water again.
If we use it as drinking water.
If we use it as drinking water.
I can make a comment too. Is that you can't assume that the collection system is completely tied either. There's exfiltration and other issues that I think that I agree with Rob. I think that if we could address it at the point source, then it makes more sense.
The other thing I'd add is every time we save something, even if we do want to have the reclamation, it gives you the opportunity to add another housing unit. You know, so to me, it's so much the effluent might be stable, might be static, but what's producing the effluent may actually go up in terms of numbers.
Yes. You know.
So, any other questions? Or I just had. So, we've been receiving state water for how long now, Rob?
Since mid '90s, '94 ish. Okay.
And so 41 acre feet sounds like not very much pumping from the groundwater basin.
It's about 2 weeks worth of water supply for the city.
Yeah. So has that impacted the basin, the local basin, the fact that we're not regularly pumping out of it?
I think there's enough other users in the basin that, especially with the drought year, we're not seeing any real recovery in the basin because of city pumping. There's enough agricultural interests in the Morro Basin that have drawn, in many places, the basin dry, you know, in the upper watershed, that, you know, we don't really see that difference. That impact. We are downstream of the Narrows also, so it's less of an influence. There's a pinch point in the groundwater basin where it's difficult for us to affect the upstream portion of the basin. If anything, if we start over pumping, we have more of a tendency to draw salt water in than overdraft the basin.
Okay. Now we're talking about hydrology. where does the new regulations and the new recommendations from the governor fit in with all of this? Are they going to be monitoring the basin better? Or are we going to be able to harvest more water
so
from the basin?
The new regulation for monitoring of groundwater basins doesn't affect Morro Basin because it's not on the state's list of critical aquifers because of the size of the basin, basically. There in this county, it's Paso Robles Groundwater Basin and Santa Maria Groundwater Basin that are the two critical water supply aquifers that we could potentially voluntarily go in and put ourselves in that program for monitoring of that basin. I think we need to know a lot more about that basin in terms of groundwater recharge before we proceed forward. And then the other regulations, this is what I thought you were talking about, but I might as well put a plug in for it, that the governor ordered developed is for use of reclaimed water. For indirect potable use, he's ordered the newly formed drinking water program within the state water board. It's moved out of the health department and into the water board to develop regulations for indirect potable and ultimately direct potable, or what is known as, you know, my favorite term, toilet to tap.
So, yeah. So it sounds like this year, and historically, I understand, only a small proportion of the available water permits have been utilized for residential and commercial. What would be the effect if they were all utilized? What would be the effect if the established allocation were all used up for several years?
There'd be a moratorium on construction. So, in effect, we would stop construction activities due to lack of allocatable water.
How would that moratorium take effect?
We would stop issuing building permits and stop issuing planning permits. Scott would have a lot of time to work on the plan.
No, but I'm saying, I'm not saying that we exceed the allowable allocation. What I'm saying is, what if we just? I think you said there were 40 residential and
65 commercial
65
units
commercial.
Allocated.
So what if they just? What if 40 residential applications came in and 65 business applications came in for 3 or 4 years? Would that just mean that we'd be using more state water, or would it adversely impact our water supply?
That would mean that we'd be – this is based on our water management plan, so it's the amount of available water we had at the time. We probably need to revisit that, especially based on the security of state water. When most everybody started using state water, it was viewed as the – unlimited, endless supply of water coming from Sacramento. And they would keep it flowing through the pipes forever. And unlimited quantities, or only limited by the pipe capacity.
Yeah.
We're finding out that that's not true, because there's other things that affect that. The water quality in the Delta to be the major impact is maintaining that water quality in the Delta. And, there's several species that are endangered that affect the amount of water that can be pumped through. So last year, we started out with a zero allocation of state water to the city of Morro Bay. The state increased it to 5%. We had 3,000 acre feet of water in storage in San Luis Reservoir, which is the reservoir adjacent to I-5, 152 Hollister, that reservoir there. So it's south of the Delta, so it was available for us to draw on. We used that in addition to the 0%, which was later in the year increased to 5% allocation. We used that to make up the difference. So now we have about 2,000 acre feet of storage, but this year DWR increased the allocation to 15%. So we are getting 15% of our normal allocation plus drought buffer. There's a interesting formula for actually how much water we get based on our purchase insurance policy or drought buffer. So we are only probably going to have to tap into that water and storage to the tune of about 500 acre feet this year. So that'll be remain 2,500 acre feet in storage. There'll be a point, though, where we're going to be the only ones with water south on the coastal branch with water and storage. And there's a large water treatment plant and pumping station that can't efficiently only pump to Morro Bay. They're not going to turn on that big plant and only supply Morro Bay with water. They need their big Santa Barbara County customers to make that work. If drought continues several years, we'll be facing the need to run our desal plant more.
And is the capacity of the desal plant is enough to supply all of our water needs, if necessary?
All of our conserving water needs.
Uh-huh.
So, and we can push it to get a little bit more, but we don't have the calcium carbonate capacity to run it. We'd have to have trucks pulled up there all the time to reload calcium carbonate, which is one of the chemicals we use to, believe it or not, we have to harden the water after we run it through the desal because it's become so soft that it's aggressive on plumbing fixtures. So we add calcium carbonate back into it to add a little bit of hardness so it doesn't start dissolving our water system.
Just out of curiosity, Rob, what's the status on the permit for that desal plant with the CCC?
The plant itself is permitted. It's the outfall in the saltwater wells that we're still going back and forth with coastal staff. I mean, we've had to operate it without their permit, and we let them know, and we're operate under an emergency permit when we operate the desal plant. But they're working with us on trying to get it permitted. They've had some additional requests for information on how our outfall works in the mixing zone. So our outfall is into the outfall of the old power plant is right. Where this desal discharges into. And actually, it's a pretty well-mixed zone because we're basically discharging in the surf zone. We can't find... and. The amount of our water compared to the ocean, it's difficult to find the desal reject water in the ocean after you get a few feet away from the outfall.
They're not going to require you to do a EIR there?
No.
Okay.
No, we have an existing environmental document that we're using
okay.
On that. And then they have – their process is alternative to – to CEQA, so
right.
When they permit it, it's alternative to CEQA, and it is all within their original jurisdiction is what we're looking to permit.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that.
So we don't need to take an official action on this, correct? It's going to go to City Council.
Yes,
anyway.
Only if you had any comments or concerns that we would pass along to City Council.
The only thing that I would maybe just, you know, I don't know if you have to write it, but, you know, the recent test that we had with the CERCLOS and maybe notify the, you know, in a city council meeting, notifying the public and just having that kind of explained a little bit how they found it there in the wells by, my memory serves, they found it in the wells right by the high school and not they didn't find it up at the
that's correct. Yeah, we didn't find it upstream in the Moro Valley. We found sucralose, which is the sweetener that we all use, or maybe some of us use, but it's persistent in wastewater. So it's an indicator. We tested for both caffeine and sucralose to see how many coffee drinkers we have, but seriously, to test, give an indication of if at least some of the nitrate contamination in the Moro Valley was due to the leaking, exfiltrating Main Street lines. And we're still looking at that data, but we'll be presenting at least the raw information to City Council.
Okay. Thank you.
So there was artificial sweetener, but no caffeine?
No caffeine. People are drinking decaf, I guess.
You obviously did the test on a day that I was out of town. Okay. So anything else to comment on that report? Thank you very much, Rob. I bet you thought you were done with this, and here you are back again.
You'll see me occasionally. Scott will drag me in when there's public works things, and at least once a year for this report, you'll be seeing me.
So now we have an opportunity. Now we come to the opportunity to discuss for planning commissioner comments, particularly regarding future initiatives, future thoughts about where we're going.
I would like to just throw something out there, and this may be a little too far out there, but I think that, you know, one of the things that we as a commission are going to be, like, you know, everybody's talking about
LCP general plan. And, you know, I was talking to my friend over at the skateboard museum the other day, and, you know, just trying to get their, you know, local boys' thoughts, you know, the guys that were, you know, I always feel I'm just a Pollock passing through, you know what I mean? But talking to a lot of the people that were raised and grew up here, you know, and I wonder, it would be interesting if we could have a meeting maybe around noon at the high school. I'd like to hear what the high school students, you know, where you could have it at around their lunchtime where they can actually come in and make a comment. And I don't know how practical that would be, but I feel that what we're doing here is something that they're going to be living with. So, I don't know, I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. Thanks.
You raise an interesting concept, and it's one that that I've discussed with the consultants that we work with on the plan for the plan, PMC. And it seems like that is one of the things they do more outreach on. So it's likely when we start going through the process for the general plan and LCP update that there will be some outreach to the schools. And I think it is important. So it's good that you recognize that. And it's something that, at least in talking with PMC, that they do a lot of general plan updates, mm-hmm. as a consultant group. And they do have outreach components that do go to the high school. So that's not something out of the realm. I mean, that's something that's probably real, and in some way, shape, or form, we will be probably doing something along those lines to get that input so we have that component of the populace represented. So it is important, and it's probably something that we're going to be looking at. And exactly how that looks right now, we don't know because we don't have, you know, we haven't sent out the RFP and got it back yet, but when we do go down that road, there's going to be an outreach component that involves that. So, anyway,
that's encouraging. Yeah. Thank you.
It might even be interesting for maybe a government class or social studies class at the high school to take on input to the general plan LCP as a project, you know, a semester project.
Scott, do you have any idea when the memos are going to be presented to the City Council?
Now you've made your decision to board it on, and it's off to City Council tomorrow.
Sorry. Now that you've made your decision to move them forward, I'll be talking to the city clerk tomorrow about that. And I'll send an email out to you and let you know when they're going to get it, okay?
Because, okay. I would love to see as much public comment and as much interaction as we can get on that because, you know, it would be great to get the community support.
Okay.
Kind of echoing what Jerry said, I've been on the Planning Commission, about 4 months, and with the exception of one, maybe two meetings, we have had absolutely no one coming down in public comment. And I just wondered, I think that might be a good idea for us to kind of chat or discuss ways we can outreach more to the community, because I can really only remember one time when people actually came in and talked to us about a project, with the exception of the sponsors of the project. In addition, I think that it's important for any time that you may get emails or any comment electronically to share it with us. I assume you would, but again, it's as we go forward in finalizing our design guidelines and any of those type of things, and certainly if we go on to commercial, we're doing it in somewhat of a vacuum, and because there has been very little public comment.
We've plugged it at, every opportunity, and the council has as well. Obviously, the council gets a little more attendance than the Planning Commission does, and quite a bit more. That's an interesting dynamic, actually. The council gets quite a bit of public comment in the beginning of their meetings. People seem to be dialed into that very much so, and a little less so to the Planning Commission. I'm not sure why that is in this city, but that seems to be the case. I mean,
we had a process that we had started before that we had, we were doing design guidelines for the downtown area, and we were working towards a specific plan there. And we had a community meeting where there were at least, you know, Michael was there, I think a good 100-150 people showed up. It was really encouraging to see that. And it was a robust exchange, and I hope we have that same type of interaction.
My sense from this being my second stint on here is that the vast majority of things that come before us, I don't think the neighborhoods are really concerned about. The small minority of things that come before us, I can remember when we were talking about the signs. We had people in here about signs. We had people in here certainly about several hot button parcels that were under development for residences. We had, you know, lots of people in here. So I think in general, it's not necessarily a bad thing that people aren't here. I think there'll be some things where we want to solicit opinions like VLCP, that is something we want to talk about. But on a typical, I think people see the documents, people parse them. You know, I get a few emails here and there, but by and large, I think we don't always have something controversial. Not everything has a, you know, dialectic, you know, problem. It's some things are just pretty simple, and we're just maybe in a good simple stretch here.
You will be seeing more interesting things coming forward because we're in the process right now with the council of setting our goals, and so once those are finalized, I'm going to bring them to the Planning Commission so you know what I'm doing. And so this leads, I mean, your letter leads into that because the council sets the direction for what I do, what Rob does. You know, there's expectations, there's timelines that go along with those, and, you know, a lot of the things are, at this point, have an 18-month window on them where we're supposed to be completing them, and the sign requirements in the update, completing that, that's it. That's one of the things that's on there. The downtown specific plan, moving that forward, that's one of the things that's on there. So those things, the things that you say that, you know, people were more interested in, well, they're going to be coming forward because that's the direction of the council. So you will get some things that are a little meatier and a little more than a, you know, addition to a single family house and something that's more global. It affects, you know, areas of the city versus maybe a street. And so I would imagine you're probably going to get some more folks here as a result of taking on those, especially in the downtown. I think, you know, we hit that with the downtown specific plan concept and what we're doing there in connection between downtown and the Embarcadero. That's another thing we're looking at. There'll be more folks engaged at that point.
Just to add to that, you know, I think it's important to have public input on, particularly on things that are of general interest, like design guidelines. But I think we should consider making sure that we have representative public input, you know, rather than just the people who happen to be upset enough to come to the meeting. You know, that as we move forward, particularly with some of the, like the general plan, the LCP, and the things that are long-term issues, there needs to be an outreach as well to the guy who's, you know, worked a 12-hour day and he's just too tired to get, you know, to get up after dinner and come down here and, you know, talk to us. So I think it's also important to get a cross-section of the community.
Especially for the general plan, the outreach strategies that go along with that do that because there's going to be polling options, Survey Monkey options for people that, you know, want to participate, but like you said, you know, they worked a long day. Maybe they're not going to be able to come to the workshop that we have, but they certainly can answer the online poll, you know, that we have and have the input that way. And so that, you know, it's going to be a multi, you know, media sort of process to it, where we have workshops, where you have potentially pop up neighborhood things where they have. That's one of the things that we've talked about. And you have surveys that go out, not only physical surveys that maybe go out in water bills, but ones that are online. So it will be.
Scott, does the city have a citizens email list?
We have the, was it the Notify?
If you sign up for the Notify Me, so if you want to get Planning Commission issues,
right.
Then people sign up for it. They get the email when there's a Planning Commission meeting, you know, with the agenda on it. And we have that for all of our advisory boards, plus a kind of a general city one also.
So do we have a sense of what percentage of households have signed up for?
I can't even remember what the number
I know,
is.
It's not fair to spring that question.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, just off the top of my head, I can tell you it's 14.7%.
The information is available, though. It is tracked, so we could find that out.
Because I have a sense that people will respond more if they get an email than if you simply say, oh, it's on our website, go check it out, you know, vote kind of thing. So maybe one idea would be to, and I'm just throwing this out, you know, probably, but as we start into the general plan LCP, maybe we should start a mailing list for general plan LCP issues that people
there's going to be a web page for it as well. That's going to be something that's ongoing and has all the latest updates to what we're doing, where we're at, all, you know, the draft documents and things like that. When we do that process, all that's part of the package. So we will have that opportunity. Well, there'll be a technical advisory committee that's appointed as part of that.
It'll be an easy place to put a notify me button. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
One other question. I believe all of us have received 2 email letters in the last week or so. How do we address those going forward?
You've received email letters
from different people, you know, wanting to discuss an unsafe intersection. Also, an email regarding a project, and I don't know how anything's ever reported back to us on the outcomes of those.
Well, you'd have to be specific, and you would always, when you receive things like that, you always want to make sure that there's, when you're looking on the line for who that's being sent to, that it is being sent to city staff, because we do review all of those things when they come in, especially complaints, or when they point out there's issues somewhere, it goes to the appropriate department, and then we take a look at it, you know, from there. So if there are specific, you know, follow-up questions that you have, if you get those to me, then I'll look in to see where we're at with it and report back to you. I mean, I can do it in the form of an email to all of you, or simply at the next Planning Commission meeting, however you want that to happen.
Thank you. So,
and if you're talking about Pacific as the intersection, Pacific and Maine?
No.
Okay. That's going to council.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I got a question, and maybe it's Brown Act. There was a project on Juniper, and there's a meeting that's supposed to be coming on later on this week. And it was in an email. Now, if three of us show up there, does that make it a quorum?
That was one of the.
Yeah.
Okay. Whoops, I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, but you certainly shouldn't be discussing it together. If you show up someplace, you should not be discussing anything that's going on there together, because that would absolutely be a Brown Act violation.
Right, right. Okay? So that makes it...
I always kind of caution the commission, you know, about if those things happen and you find yourself in one of those neighborhood meetings and there's 3 of you, that maybe one of you might want to leave.
Yeah.
because the perception can sometimes be as bad as, you know, actually doing it. So I always tend to err on the side of caution when it comes to those things. 2 of you there, not a problem. 3, we have a potential issue and people taking note of that. And I don't know that you want to, you know, be subject to that.
Okay. So then I guess it's time for us to hear from you. If you have comments you'd like to make to us, or
yeah, I
had
a couple
news.
I have a couple of things. let me see here. We had the Planning Commissioner Academy coming up, and I've just kind of finished the booking for the 3 of you that are going. So, Commissioner Sadowski, Commissioner Teff, Commissioner Sorensen, I've made the reservations. It's at the in Newport at the hotel where the conference is being held, and I will be putting together a package for all of you, including what the mileage reimbursement is. There's a bit of a per diem that goes with it. I'll let you know what those are, as well as direction as it relates to keeping your receipts for things that you buy so that we can, some of it can be reimbursed at least. We have a handout that kind of goes along with that. So I'm going to put all that together for you. I'm working out how we are going to be paying at the hotel right now. I've put it all on one of the credit cards, but I don't think it's enough. So I'm going to maybe get a separate check. Anyway, you're going to get a package from me that gives you all that information. And I'll probably put a map in there for you and all that type of stuff too, so you don't get lost. You know where it's at. Second item, we do have a tentative date for a joint planning commission and city council meeting for March 24th at 4:30 to 5:30. And that would be to roll out the plan for the plan. We have it back, and I've had it for a while now, back from PMC. We are holding on to it, and I haven't released it to the world because we are having an issue with our LCP grant. There's a conflict, time conflict in it, where our LCP and the grant time frame for it is supposed to be done in 2 years. Our LCP update is supposed to be done in 3 years. That doesn't work. So we've been working that out with coastal staff and trying to come to an understanding about what that's going to look like. And do we, at the end of the time, when we're done with everything, is there the opportunity to extend it? Because it's problematic, you know, from a funding standpoint. It's expensive to do general plan update. It's why it's been strewn, put out over 3 years. Part of the discussion we're going to have on that day. Not only are we going to show it to you, but there is timelines in it. There is high and low cost estimates. There is the grants that we have plugged into it. And then there's an area that shows you the shortage for year one, for year two, for year three. So all that should prove fairly interesting and should get a pretty lively discussion out of it. And again, it is tentatively scheduled for March 24th. I see no reason why we wouldn't meet that. And I actually just got response back from the Coastal Commission about direction on it. So we're going to do a little more fine-tuning and maybe have another conversation with them, and I'll know a little bit more about it. But it seems like it's going to work out. So I wasn't too sure to begin with. They said it's a hard deadline, and then said it's a hard deadline, but. And so the but was a good thing. And so we're working on that right now. So that's the I think that's all I have for you. So, yes, it's a regular council meeting, so it would be on the fourth Tuesday, I guess.
There was an issue brought up about traffic safety, traffic concerns. We do have a let us know module, so if somebody wants to input that information, it eventually gets its way after an associate engineer gets it to my desk for us to look at. We have done intersection studies in town to determine whether additional traffic control devices are appropriate or not. There is, for residential intersections, let's say it's a stop sign request, if it would determine that no stop sign is warranted or there's, nothing that would require it, there's a petition process so that citizens could come forward to council and request a stop sign even at an unwarranted location. And council could order that stop sign to be installed.
I got a quick question for you, Rob. By Del Mar, I think the street's called Greenwood. Is that a safety corridor?
Greenwood was designated as a pedestrian pathway. So there's three types of streets that require sidewalk improvements as development goes on. Collector streets, arterial streets, and designated pedestrian pathways. So ultimately, as properties redevelopment, or if we get some external money, Greenwood will eventually have sidewalks.
Yeah, there's one of the concerns I write over there, one of the concerns is San Jacinto and Greenwood. I don't think there's a stop sign there. Maybe I'm thinking something wrong there.
There probably isn't. I think the stop sign there is at the San Jacinto is at the top of the hill.
Yeah, there's one, and I think
that's... Or is it on Ironwood facing... There's no stop sign for San Jacinto.
Up the hill. The only reason why I'm bringing that up, one of the parents at the school mentioned it to me, so I'm just... Well, thinking out loud.
Sorry. Okay.
Okay, so if... I'm sorry.
I was going to say, one of those intersections has a pretty good swale there for the runoff. You don't stop, but you better slow down.
Yeah, we put a couple of cross gutters in there that are good speed bumps.
Okay, so if there are no other issues or comments, then we will adjourn to our next regular commission meeting, which will be here at the Veterans Memorial Building on February 17th at 6 p.m. Thank you very much.